Hello, everyone. The date is October 25th, 2021. Let me begin with some comments and questions. A couple of people have been asking me about histories. I'm referring to conservative Judaism. Of course, there's histories of that. But the sort of thing I'm talking about is not so much history of the conservative movement. At least my interest in much of what we're dealing with is interest in the Jewish Theological Seminary, which, although it's the rabbinical school for the conservative movement, was independent in many ways. And if anyone is interested, you can check out this. Two volumes, Tradition Renewed. Look how thick this is. This will give you everything you want to know from really top people on the seminary. Edited by Jack Wertheimer. I want to respond to a couple things here. First, Nat Lewin, who I see is with us. So let me just respond to everyone. He makes a very interesting point. First, he says, we spoke last class about Rabbi Ralbag and burning the sitter. And he heard, and maybe others heard, that I was making an analogy to Nazi burning. I never did that. What I said was that's what Kaplan said, and that's what the newspapers were. They were contrasting the Nazis burning Jewish books versus the burning of the Kaplan book. But he makes a very interesting point that the burning of the Kaplan book was a symbolic book burning. It culminated a formal proceeding. This is unlike the Nazis who burned Jewish books and the Catholics who set fire to the Talmud volumes. Their job was they were interested in destroying all the volumes they could. And this was more symbolic. And I accept that. That's a very interesting point. He also comments, though, that rather than putting the stress, if you want to talk about, I didn't speak enough about the Agudas Rabbanim, perhaps, because they were the ones who put the Cherem on the book. Look, at the end of the day, I don't see a problem. If the book bothers them, they could put a Cherem on the book. It's just that it doesn't really play very well, as Rabbi Lamb said, in the modern day and age. I was asked about the Reconstructionist Siddur. Does it mention God's name? And I said, yes, it certainly mentions God's name, but I didn't have the sitter with me at the time. I'm going to show you now a copy of the sitter. I found it very quickly online. So let me pull that up for you, and you can see that as well. Here you go. Should be on your screen now. Here is just a page from the sitter, from the Shmon Esrei. And you see it mentions God's name. So who is God? What is God? Well, it means different things to different people. Kaplan spoke about it in terms of like the power that allows you to find salvation in this. Basically the force that leads you to good. There's different understandings of how to understand it. It's not a personal God, but they still use God, the name. Now, I'm going to show you, let me show you the Shema, because we saw that Ginsburg, Marx, and Lieberman were contemptuous of Kaplan abridging the Shema. So here's the Shema. It begins the way we know it. But then you go to the next page, and lo and behold, the first paragraph is okay. And then for some reason, Laman Yirbu comes next. And then Vahaya, you don't have the regular Vahaya. It's they created their own Vahaya. Why? I have no idea. And then you see the Vayomer is Vayomer. So I'm not sure why they did that, but it's crazy, as was pointed out. I actually have a copy of the current Reconstructionist Siddur. It's called Kohan Neshama, Reconstructionist Press. And also it mentions God's name, but they'll take out all sorts of things. They're not crazy about Jewish particularism and obviously messianic ideas, but you'll find some unusual things that are in there you might not expect. You have Avinu Malkeinu here. And it says, for instance, Kasveinu b'sefer panosav chakala, Kasveinu b'sefer zchios, our creator, our sovereign, inscribe us for good fortune in the book of life. Now, if they don't really believe in a personal God, what are they having this prayer inscribe us? Because for Reconstructionism, the the folkways, the traditional liturgy still has value, even if today you don't take it literally the way we might in the past. That just reminds me, I'm curious what they say about, I was going to say about Mechaye HaMesim, but looking here, they don't have it here, so I'd be curious how they translated it. But they do have, they don't have the end bracha, but they do have, they change it to Mechaye Kol Chai, that blessed are you, the fount of life who gives and renews life. So it's like the old Supreme Court question of in God we trust. You can interpret God meaning all sorts of things. That's why when they made the compromise in the Israeli Declaration of Independence, they couldn't say God, Chas V'Shalom, so instead they settled on Tzur, the rock of Israel, because rock could mean the history, rock could mean the strength of the Jewish people, and rock could mean, obviously, the personal God. I want to thank Mike for calling my attention to something I did not know, and it's because I'm not in the Midwest. I showed you last class from this Michigan hashkacha, which I had never heard of, and they made a whole thing about how now you have conservative hashkachas, and we have to be careful that the rabbi is an Orthodox rabbi, Yeshua has a machitza. And I said that I've seen, in Philadelphia, you had a conservative rabbi gave hashkacha on some vegan places, but I haven't seen much. And I know of one item in my local supermarket that's a conservative rabbi, and it's a sort of thing. It's like, as I recall, chopped onions. So we're not dealing with anything complicated. However, Mike points out that there is such a thing, but all the products, I've never seen any of these products. They all seem to be in local Michigan products. I want to show you what they were referring to. I think you'll find it of interest. I did not even know such a thing existed. Maybe it's more than just Michigan. You have something in Michigan called Kosher Michigan with all sorts of products, and this is a conservative rabbi. So I get why in Detroit you can go here, you can look at the directory, and he's really giving the look at all these products. It goes a whole list of them. So he's really giving a run for the money for to the Orthodox. So I get now why they mention it. A number of you asked about. We spoke last class. About the choir. It's Passion Portuguese. Someone said, are there non-Jews in it? I said, they can't be non-Jews there. Well, I emailed the Shamus, Zachary Ettinger, and apparently a number of you also emailed him. And I got the whole report here. There's no non-Jews in the choir. It's not like they're checking, though, as he explains so carefully. You don't, I mean, throughout historically, halachic Jews or not, but they're all self-identifying Jews. He did call my attention to something they found in the archives that Rabbi Kassin wrote to Rabbi DeSola Poole many decades ago. I think it was in the 40s. I don't have it in front of me now to check. Or 50s, that he heard reports that people came on the subway to come to the choir. And that's obviously a problem. Rabbi DeSola Poole's answer was, we can't control what people do on their own time like that. I want to thank Sarah. Sarah called my attention. I'm really happy I made this public. Sarah called my attention to the following. Remember, I said that the rabbi is walking down the aisle who haven't seen this? She writes to me that her and her husband were listening to the talk, and she said that my husband and I revived the custom at our wedding in 1993. Our parents felt it was a nice way to give kavod to the rabbis in attendance who did not necessarily get brachot under the chuppah. And she gives the whole list of who was in the rabbinic procession. She says at the time, many guests commented how nice it was. And it set the tone for the chuppah, but it didn't catch on. So here you have Dr. Lamb, Rabbi Lamb. On the left, you have Rabbi Max Schreier. And in the middle, that's Rabbi Yecheskel Besser. And there were others who walked down the aisle. She says Rabbi Rucham Olshan from the Lakewood Yeshiva, Rabbi Moshe Teitelbaum. So I don't know. Are we going to bring this custom back? But thank you very much, Sarah, for that. I looked up in the Masoras Moshe, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. What he said about Rav Tzair. Actually, before I do that, I want to share in the comments here, anyone who's interested in watching the Chazon Ish talk that we spoke about of me and it. It's in the comments. I looked up in the Masorah Samosa. I wasn't exact in my memory. The story is as follows. It says this is in Masorah Samosa, volume 1, page 574, that he met Rav Tzair, and he told Rav Tzair told Rav Moshe that he's also a rabbi, but a little bit from the Sitra Achra, from the other side. And Rav Moshe replied, "If you yourself know that you're from the Sitra Achra, why don't you be Chozer B'tshuva?" I didn't. What I said last class was that he gave excuses. According to this source, he doesn't give excuses. In this, the way I said that it's too difficult, he doesn't say anything. But then the story is repeated in Masorah Shmosa, volume 2, page 490. And here he says that Rav Tzair, after Ramosha said, "Why don't you do tshuva?" he replied, or why he says, "What are you doing? You're on the wrong side." He said that, "Well, I can be makariv them," things like that. And Ramosha replies to him that, "I don't think you're going to be makariv them. I'm afraid they're going to be makariv you." And we know that's what happened. I have two more things to share with you. Here's a very important book. This is called The Sanctity of the Synagogue. The case for Machitza. It has all the documents. I don't know if you can see it here. Yeah. During the great Machitza dispute that happened in the 50s. I mentioned how the Agudas Rabbanim would continuously come out with these public calls, declarations, not to go to a non-Machitza shul. And these were directed to everyone. And I said that the Rav, he was only speaking to Orthodox Jews. If anyone doubts what I said, you can look in this book, page 110, where the Rav gives his strongest elaboration of the importance of separate seating. That's where he uses the term Christianization of the synagogue. But then he says as follows: "I do hereby." Well, first he says, "I reiterate my statement that such a synagogue forfeits its sanctity." Quote. "With full cognizance of the implications of such a halachic decision, I would still advise every Orthodox Jew to forego tefillah b'tzibur, even on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, rather than enter the inner synagogue with mixed pews, notwithstanding the fact that the officiating rabbi happens to be a graduate of a great and venerable yeshiva." I think we can medayek in what the Rav says. He's saying, "I would advise every Orthodox Jew." He's not advising the typical Jew who doesn't know any better. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his letter to Rabbi Shubo's synagogue, says he recognizes the value and the significance of this institution. He doesn't call it a shul, but this, I forget the exact language. But the Rav is not saying, he's not speaking to the non-Orthodox, the ones who don't know any better. But for Orthodox Jews, or those who grew up in an Orthodox environment, who know better, that's who he's speaking to. I think the Rav was very careful in his language. He's not saying, as the Agudas Rabbanim said, that no Jew should, that every Jew should forego tefillah b'tzibur. He's speaking to Orthodox Jews. That's the language he uses, and that's how I have always understood him. And one more thing, and then we'll pick up. This takes us back a few classes more into the last semester, but I do want to say it because many of you were with us, and it was an error, or it was unclear on my part. I was speaking, I think a number of you will remember this, I was speaking about this crazy document I found in the, I got from the archives from, it was copied, it was originally handwritten by this Aryeh Weisfisch during the time when there's a fear that the Germans were going to actually enter the land of Israel, and it's writing to the Arabs saying that we, like Naturi Karta types, we have nothing to do with politics, and we're just quiet Jews, and basically protect us, don't let us be killed, that sort of thing. I forgot to mention, I said for some reason, I don't know why I said that this Leib Weisfisch was Satmar. He's not Satmar at all. I knew he wasn't Satmar. I just was thinking in terms of anti-Zionism. Those who are interested can read all about Leib Weisfisch. You can see him online. You can read about him on Wikipedia. He was a big Naturi Karta person, also an expert in Nietzsche. Can you believe that? Naturi Karta and Nietzsche joined together. With that, we pick up where we left off, and I want to, let me get my materials here. We got some really fascinating stuff today. Before I start, Asher Reimer wants me to clarify one more time, what's the difference? We're speaking about Lieberman, his Talmudic studies. And we're going to come back to that. Josefta Bishutu, we haven't even spoken about that. And they kept saying that what he does is lower criticism, not higher criticism. So what is lower criticism? So again, lower criticism is textual criticism, that this is a mistake in the text. It should read something else. Lieberman does that, and of course, Lieberman, which he sees as an absolute essential element of pshat, of explaining the pshat. Higher criticism is looking at sources. So he's speaking higher criticism of the Pentateuch. This source comes from here, that source comes from there. You're also interested in also the assumptions. So what led the writers, what was at their disposal that they came to this conclusion versus that conclusion? Basically, you're rewriting our understanding of the whole conceptual basis of the halachot. Lieberman didn't do anything like that. The end of last class, the last thing we did was Lieberman, an open letter to Lieberman from Agudas Rabbanim, demanding, how can you remain at the seminary when none other than Mordechai Kaplan is there? He's been put in Cheirim. Lieberman writes back to them. This is where we ended. So right before the publication, I published this volume. This is the reprint. Kisvei Reb Chaim Yaakov Weinberg, Volume 2. Shortly before the publication of this volume, I made an amazing discovery. I spend a lot of time in archives. Many of you probably know that. I've been fortunate to discover things. Archives, I think, they're a bit, if I can paraphrase Forrest Gump, archives are like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. And it's true. Because you'll see archives, many archives today are online, so you can sit at your desk. Israel State Archives, I sit at my desk every other day. I try to go through some of them. But even before that, I traveled all over the world, to Europe, but obviously to Israel, and many different libraries, to individuals' homes, where they let me, all sorts of stuff. And often when I go to libraries, you'd see archives and they look very promising because it's a figure you know that had interesting correspondence, and you get there and it's disappointing. You have to assume that the good stuff was thrown out. And other times you just look at things where you don't expect anything and you find you hit gold, pay dirt. Such an example happened to me with the archives of this individual. Show you on a screen. I bet some of the people listening to us right now were Talmidim of this individual. None other than Rav David Lifshitz, known as the Suvalker Rav, who I think it was 1941, he was able to get out of Europe, makes his way, of course, to New York, where Dr. Belkin gives him a position at the yeshiva, and he was Rosh Yeshiva for decades with many Talmidim. He also was very had wide-ranging knowledge in Hebrew literature, all sorts of things. Very interesting. And he's the father-in-law, by the way, of two also interesting individuals, Rabbi Nussan Kamenetsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and Dr. Chaim Waxman. So Professor Chaim Waxman, sociologist at Rutgers, now living in Israel. Professor Waxman told me that they donated the archives of his father-in-law to Yeshiva University. And I didn't think there'd be much in there of interest to me. Rav David Lifshitz was involved in the Agudas Rabbanim, and really he was involved in Rabbi Henkin's organization, Ezra's Torah. But I figure I used to go before COVID, I often would go to YU to use the archives. So when I'm there once, I ask them to see the archives. It wasn't much. I found actually a letter from Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, an approbation type letter telling people to, he was traveling around raising money for the Mir Yeshiva that to give him money. But other than that, there wasn't much in there. I'm turning the pages, and then I come across a copy of a letter from none other than Shaul Lieberman, which obviously was circulated among Agudas Rabbanim members. Nothing less than his justification for remaining at the seminary. This letter was mentioned in a pardes. The pardes, the issue after the one where they attack and they say that they got a letter from Lieberman where he justifies himself, but they don't say what's in it. So this was a great, great discovery. And this letter has been spoken about by many people. I included it in as the appendix here. which had a relevance because in volume one, I include two letters of Roy Weinberg to Shaul Lieberman. So let me tell you what he says in this letter. Well, first of all, in the letter, Lieberman expresses his pain that an open letter in Apartheid is published against him. He says, if the leaders of Agudas Rabbanim thinks it's forbidden for me to teach there, why not summon him before a Basin? He says, his language is, let me read it to you. He says, why did you bring him to a Basin? Are you worried that I'll refuse to come to a Basin of Gedolei Torah? He's saying, of course I'll come to the Basin and I'll explain why I'm doing it. Today we live in an era where all sorts of people refuse summons to a Basin. But Lieberman's saying, of course I wouldn't. And then he says, incredibly, he says, I'm going to give you a sod, a secret here. I'm going to reveal it secretly. He says, before leaving Eretz Yisrael, I consulted with three Gedolim, Gedolei Yerushalayim, that everyone, Shekol Yisrael, Makir Besamchutam, all Jews recognize their authority. And then he says, and I will, if necessary, I will tell you who they are. He realizes now it's a problem and he doesn't want to bring them into this controversy. But he says, if you need to know, I will tell you. What do they say to him? He continues the letter. One of the people he consulted did not want to give a ruling one way or the other. The second said explicitly, "She'ein hu roe iser baror." He doesn't see a clear prohibition to teach at the seminary. And this is not so difficult to understand, especially if you're in Israel and you don't know the whole situation, the conflict, because there's no prohibition to teach non-Orthodox Jews. There's no prohibition to teach in a non-Orthodox institution, as long as you're teaching in line with traditional Torah values. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a few different tshuvot in which he's asked about teaching in a conservative Hebrew school in a situation where the teachers would have the freedom to teach. You have it today. You have Lakewood people teaching in these conservative Talmud Torahs, as long as they are given permission to just teach Chumash the proper way or whatever they're going to teach. Are you allowed to do that? And Rav Moshe rules that as long as you're not pressured to teach anything in opposition to tradition, and especially if you need the money, it's permitted to teach in a non-Orthodox Talmud Torah. And we know that there's a long tradition of Orthodox Jews teaching at non-Orthodox Talmud Torahs. I never officially taught there, but when I lived in Boston, I would be called sometimes like the substitute. So on a Sunday morning, I'd go there. Ramosha, as I said, he has more than one tshuva on it. It's not like it's 100% because he says also, but if you do teach at a conservative Talmud Torah, you are not, he doesn't believe you should be teaching at an Orthodox school at the same time. So although when I went to yeshiva, you had plenty of people who taught at the yeshiva. And then for extra money, especially in those days, it was very difficult. The rebbes, they only worked half a day. Only in the morning. So what did they do in the afternoon? Many of them taught at Talmud Torahs. Rav Moshe is actually very uncomfortable with this. And he's really more of a machmir. He says that although obviously there's positive aspects, you're teaching the kids Torah. On the other hand, people will assume, he says, that since you're teaching both at an Orthodox school and a conservative school, that if you want to send your kids to a Talmud Torah, you could send it to the conservative one. Because after all, the rebbes are teaching at the conservative Talmud Torah. So what's the difference? I'm talking about a day when some Orthodox or people went to Orthodox shuls didn't go to yeshiva. So you had a choice, which Talmud Torah. You might say, well, look, this Rebbe, I know he teaches at the school, I could send to the conservative. And that's a problem because even though the Rebbe might be teaching in the Orthodox approach, once you're in a conservative synagogue, you become a member, all these sorts of things. Furthermore, Rav Moshe goes further and says that, he's worried that even the teacher might be influenced by the school. So he says that you should only do this if you really need the money. And don't do it l'shem shemayim. It's incredible that Rav Moshe says this, but Rav Moshe says, don't teach in a conservative Talmud Torah l'shem shemayim. Say you're going to do it to expose the kids to Torah. Because he says you could do that. There's plenty of kids, Orthodox kids, there are kids who are not in Kiruv sort of thing. There's plenty of opportunities to expose people to Torah. You don't need to dafka be in the institution. the conservative institution. You can find public school kids. You can do all sorts of things. But so Ramosha concludes, if you need the money, okay, you need the money, then you do it. But he's not 100% comfortable with it. But at the end of the day, it's permissible. So we can understand why the sage in Jerusalem would say, you're going to go teach Torah? Okay. You're teaching Torah. You're not teaching anything in opposition to Torah. And the Shlishi, the third, said to him, listen to this. Ataha ish, you're the man. Go and be successful. So not grudging acceptance or neutral, but actually encouraging him. Uvavad shelo tishtak hasham. Just make sure you don't stay there. Go there for a few years. You teach them. And then you come back. Very interesting. So I'll return to this later in a second. But who were these three sages? That's obviously the question everyone's going to want to know. One must certainly have been Rav Herzog. Rav Yitzhak Herzog, chief rabbi, the closest friend, Lieberman's closest friend, Rabbi Herzog's family says Lieberman was Rav Herzog's closest friend. Rabbi Shaul Lieberman led the efforts to make him chief rabbi. Rav Herzog was the honorary president of the Harry Fischel Institute. Obviously, Lieberman is not coming to New York. He's not leaving the Fischel Institute without consulting with Rav Herzog, who's the president of it. I don't know what thing Rabbi Herzog said. If he didn't give yes or no, if he said it's okay, or if he was enthusiastic, I have no idea. But Rav Herzog is definitely one of the three. Shochan and Spiro, in their book, they take note of this letter that I published, and they ask Dov Zlotnick about this, Professor Dov Zlotnick. We're going to come back to Dov Zlotnick later, because Dov Zlotnick, who's also at the seminary and was close to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and I'll play you what the Zlotnicks, we'll watch the video of Zlotnick and the Rebbe and speaking about the seminary. And we'll get to that, and what the Lubavitcher Rebbe told Zlotnick, why he could remain at the seminary. So they asked Dov Zlotnick. Now, Dov Zlotnick was a chacham. He was a wise man. He knew about Mishnayos and Talmud and all these things. I have to say, though, he didn't know much about the Gedolei Yerushalayim, with all due respect to him. Oh, I'm also going to tell you later about Dov Zlotnick's, when he gave me mussar at the wedding. You'll decide who was right. Why do I say that? It's not a criticism. He didn't know. Because who did he mention? He mentioned Rav Zlotnick speculated. One was Ritzvi Pesach Frank, who was chief rabbi of Jerusalem, and the other was Lieberman's father-in-law, Meir Bar Ilan. Well, as for Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, I guess anything's possible, but I've never found any evidence that he had any relationship with Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. And as for Meir Bar Ilan, first of all, we saw already his father-in-law was opposed to Lieberman coming to the seminary. Furthermore, Bar Ilan was not by any stretch of the imagination one of the Gedolei Yisrael in Jerusalem. He was an Askan. He was the head of the Mizrahi. He was the son of a Gedol Yisrael, the Netziv, but he was not a Gedol by any stretch of the imagination. So who was it? I think, again, this is just speculation, unless more evidence comes to light, but I would, if I had to guess on two more, I would say, first of all, Rav Ishi Zalman Meltzer. Why do I say Rav Ishi Zalman Meltzer? Because he was, of course, a universally recognized sage, and he was also on the board, the advisory board of the Harry Fischel Institute. It makes sense that Lieberman would consult with one of them. And also Rav Charlap, Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. He also was on the advisory board of the Harry Fischel Institute. I just assume that if Lieberman is going to be abandoning his post, remember, it's only temporary at this time, but leaving the Harry Fischel Institute, he's going to ask the Gedolim, who are on the presidium. And that would be Rav Herzog, of course. And I think also Rav Ishi Zalman Meltzer and Rabbi Charlap. That's the latter two is just speculation. And we don't know who said what. Now, let me return to Lieberman's letter. He continues. And this explains why he agreed. Whether he knew all the details of the seminary, we said it's not clear. But he knew it wasn't, quote, orthodox. Exactly what that means, we're not clear about. But he says as follows. He says this to Rabbi Pardes. This is a letter to Rabbi Pardes, which was then circulated among the Agudas Rabbanim. He says, "In the seminary is a Mossad Chashuv. It's an important institution." He says, "They allow me the freedom to teach what I want and how I want. No interference at all." He says, regarding this institution, if only another two or three Torah scholars, there's Torah true scholars, Shlumei Emunei Yisrael, would come in, we would turn it into a wonderful Torah institution. All we need are two or three more Orthodox teachers. And that explains why Lieberman made such efforts to bring in not just Orthodox scholars, but even Gedolei Yisrael. Bachurei Yisrael to Mimimim. He says about the students at the seminary, this is 1946, they're innocent or they're wonderful. I don't know how you want to translate to Mimim. I think they're innocent. They haven't been, that's the best way to put it. They haven't yet been exposed to incorrect ideologies. They're coming to become rabbis. And there's nothing that influences like the light of Torah. Here he's speaking very rabbinically. And by the light of Torah, which is placed in them, Lieberman says that we, teachers who believe in the Torah, we can have such an impact on these young people. Then he says, the seminary makir ba'ofen rishmi rak b'samchut ha'Shulchan Aruch. He says the rabbinical, the seminary, Jewish Theological Seminary, officially recognizes the authority of the Shulchan Aruch. And as long as this authority is recognized, there is a hope. He says, I hope that soon, Mirtz Hashem, the Ha'atid HaKarov, the near future, will show the correctness of my choice. Turns out it didn't actually, but that's what he hopes. He says, I say with all the responsibility in my words that I am certain that my presence in the seminary prevents the breaking out of a great dispute, which would cause a chil Hashem. And he says that this should be, this letter should be private. It should not be made public. So I guess maybe it wasn't passed around the Gurus Rabbanim, just a few of them. And it shouldn't, but you can show it to who you wish. In order to prevent a chil Hashem, I request of you to publicize that you received a private letter, which I try to justify my joining the seminary's faculty. And that's exactly what Rabbi Pardes did. He published a little piece saying that Lieberman justified himself. Why does it need to be private? Spiro Shochet suggests that Lieberman didn't want to discuss publicly this is sensitive. In this matter of JTS and the Orthodox perception. I give a different perspective in my note to this. I think it's probably more likely that Lieberman is working at the seminary, but he doesn't want the people in charge, just the members of the board, maybe in Finkelstein, to know that even though he's working at the seminary, he still feels like he's under the authority of the Gedolei Yisrael. That's what I think it is. But whatever the reason was, although this letter of Lieberman probably allayed some of the suspicion and anger directed against him. It was only temporary. In fact, even for those who accepted what Lieberman said in his letter, there still would be a reason to develop a negative view in the coming years. For one, contrary to what Lieberman was told by the unnamed sage, he did remain at the seminary. He was supposed to go there temporarily, he was told by this rabbi, and Lieberman thought he was going to be temporary, but he remains there permanently. Second, the permission given to him by the Gedolim, at least two of the three, the other one didn't want to rule one way or the other, was to teach at the seminary. Precisely that, to teach. Yet in 1949, Lieberman becomes dean of the rabbinical school. In other words, his imprimatur and prestige are now behind every rabbi produced by the seminary. And he's one of the people signing the smicha. In 1959, he becomes rector of the seminary. And one of the responsibilities is, quote, guiding the general religious policy of the institution. So there's no way you can remove him from, he's not just someone coming in teaching Torah. He's not someone coming in teaching at the Talmud Torah. He is someone who's connected in the most institutional of ways. And he's part and parcel of the conservative movement. He's the rector of the rabbinical school of the conservative movement. He's assisting it at the time that the Orthodox were trying to expose what they regarded as the conservative distortions of halacha. So you can't just claim you're a teacher. He is connected intimately to the institution. Furthermore, there's no question that the leaders of the seminary and of the conservative movement were able to use the presence of Lieberman at the seminary, the Orthodox called it a cemetery, as we said, at the seminary, to help legitimize the institution when it was challenged on religious grounds. To give you one example, Chief Rabbi Herzog comes to America, comes to New York after the war. And he's invited by Finkelstein to come to the seminary. And Herzog agrees to meet with faculty members of the seminary, but he will not go but at a different place. He won't step foot in the seminary. I don't think today, by the way, Orthodox rabbi would, chief rabbi of Israel would agree to even meet with the members of the faculty. But Herzog was more moderate. He agreed to meet with some members of the faculty, but he wouldn't enter the building. Why? Because Kaplan works there. How can I enter the seminary when Kaplan's working here? Finkelstein replied to him, and this is quoted by Mel Skolt in his book on Kaplan. He has a source there. Finkelstein says as follows for Herzog: "It can't be as bad as you think if Lieberman works here." So you see how Lieberman then is being used to give a hechsher, as it were, to the seminary. Well, the presence of Kaplan at the seminary is only one problem of many mentioned in the following nasty letter that Lieberman received. In the Lieberman archives, there is a very nasty letter. I'm going to read it to you, despite its strong language. We don't know who wrote this letter. The only thing we know is that this guy wrote the same exact letter, basically, to Louis Ginsberg, which I'll read you also. But let me read you this letter, which is found in the archives. I found it, but also Shochan and Spiro. We were working on our stuff at the same exact time. My book comes, my little Kuntress comes out 2006, and theirs comes out 2005. So independently, we both found it. And here's what it says. And it's right there. Anyone can go get it. The archive is not online. A lot of things are not online, but you'll go. I have copies, obviously, of it. This is the letter. I'm sorry if I offend anyone. "Dear Sir," to Lieberman. And Lieberman saved this letter. He didn't throw it out. I think if I received this letter, I'd probably toss it in the trash. But he saved it. "Dear Sir, for the sake of Parnassa," I have to read like an Ashkenazi, "for the sake of Parnassa and glory, you have sold yourself to the Sitra Achra." Remember, that's what Rav Seir said about himself. "Do you not know that you are lending prestige to Mordechai Kaplan, Yimach Shemo, and to the other Kofrim at the seminary, as well as to the graduates, who are almost in every case Meguchei Ta'ar, that is shaved with a razor, and Bo'alei Nida? The United States has many rabbinical schools where honest young men are studying Torah and developing into Talmidei Chachamim. Is your presence at the seminary necessary for the spreading of the Torah? Or is the glamour of being a professor among Amei Haaretz with a comfortable salary so powerful that even Saul Lieberman is not man enough to withstand it? Do not withstand yourself. Do not deceive yourself that you will change the seminary. You will be influenced by them, and you will be separated from the klal of Talmidei Chachamim who have not sold themselves to Parnassa. Oy la Russia v'oy la Shreino. It's a woe to the wicked one and one to his neighbor. And you, Lieberman, are the neighbor of the wicked ones. Better to be a poor rabbi in a little synagogue than a professor who produces rabbis chotim umachtim et harabim, ones who sinners and cause others to sin. There is yet time to repent. Yours truly, a friend." Now, it doesn't have a date on it, but this is from the 40s. And this letter, as soon as I read this letter, it reminded me of something. Louis Ginsberg's son, Eli Ginsberg, in his book on his father, A Keeper of the Law, cites a letter. It's almost identical. The same, a letter that from the summer of 1948. So that could have been exactly when there was, this guy might have sent two letters the same day in the mail. One to Lieberman, one to Ginsberg. Listen to the letter to Ginsberg. After, when you hear this letter, bear in mind the following. Eli Ginsberg tells us that within 24 hours of reading this letter, Ginsberg comes down with a severe case of shingles, the effects of which plagued him for the rest of his life. But here's the letter. It's obvious the same person wrote it. Levi of Neustadt. Neustadt, Ginsberg is from Kovno, but then later on, he finally moves to Neustadt, which is in Lithuania near Germany. "Your life has been a failure. Not only have you made the Torah a kardom lachporba," that means to dig with it, something to benefit, "and you glory in the designation of professor of Talmud and great authority in halacha, when you know that there are scores of men superior to you in Talmud in this city. Not only have you helped produce rabbis who are in almost every single case, bo'alei nidot, and chotim, and machtim et harabim." That's the exact same language we saw in the Lieberman letter. Not only are you a poresh min hatzibur of the real Talmidei Chachamim who toil for the welfare of Kol Yisrael, but you have cast aspersion on the Talmud and supported the Kofrim. You declared at least twice, once in your legends and once in your students, as your book, Students, Scholars, and Saints, that the rabbis of the Talmud uttered their Haggadic statements on the spur of the moment. May the Almighty forgive you. And you support Weiss, that's Isaac Hirsch Weiss, in your denial of the authenticity of a great part of Tarsha Baal Peh. Your works are full of echoes of the Kofrim. Remember your childhood hopes, and now see yourself not only as an associate of M. Kaplan, Yimach Shemo, but also in part responsible for him and others like him. For you, the authority, have undermined the faith of these Amei Haaretz. May the Almighty open your eyes and help you recant, to recall the harmful books, to repudiate your associates, the Kofrim, and to return to the tzibur of Talmidei Chachamim. Yours sincerely, a friend. So this a friend writes the same letter, basically, to both Lieberman and Ginsburg. But no, it's Ginsburg. He accuses him of degrading the sages and writing kafira. He doesn't say that about Lieberman. Lieberman's great crime is that he's involved with an institution that has Kaplan and the rest. And yet, in opposition to this guy's letter, from Lieberman's perspective, everything he was doing was in the bounds of halacha, and he was helping rather than hurting the cause of traditional Judaism. In Spiro and Chochet, page 59 and 60, they quote from an interview that Lieberman gives to Haaretz. And Lieberman says that the dispute between myself, I'll give you the year of this interview. I don't see where they give the year here, but he says as follows, from the 50s, no doubt. The dispute between myself and the Orthodox rabbis is a long-standing affair. He says there's never been personal slander. He says, I understand them. I know their actions are in the name of God. He says they think that my actions will harm Orthodoxy, and therefore they justified in considering me a person harmful to their cause. He says, but I'm convinced of the opposite. He says, they do their thing, I do my thing, and when we meet, we discuss matters calmly. And Lieberman says, I think that if I was in their shoes, I would even be more extreme relating to someone like myself. But Lieberman says, but I have an advantage over them, for I possess knowledge of certain facts unknown to them. In other words, Lieberman is saying that by me being at the seminary, I'm able to influence people in a good way. Although, as mentioned, and not only influence people, prevent conservative Judaism from going too far to the left. He sees what he's doing as a holy action. And Lieberman, I'll read you sections of letters later, how he always regarded himself as an Orthodox Jew. We will also get into David Glinken's dispute with me, where David Glinken says we must categorize Lieberman as a conservative Jew. We'll see how he writes a whole lengthy article against my understanding in my little booklet. We'll get to my response to Glinken in a future class. But although Lieberman always regards himself as an Orthodox Jew, when it comes to his students, it's not the denominational label that's important, but their commitment to halacha. So, for example, I found in the archive, and I published in here, a letter to Chief Rabbi Isser Yehuda Unterman, in which he defends, and I'll read it to you in a second, he defends the skill and halacha acceptability of those conservative rabbis who are trained to write Gittin. In his letter, he speaks about how we're training these rabbis, and they're just as good as the Orthodox rabbis. They are very careful, and he gives an example of one in particular. I never had the pleasure of knowing this person, but Rabbi Israel Silverman. There are probably people listening to us who know about him. Here's a picture of him I found online. He dies in, let's say, 2003. Lo and behold, I don't know what this book is. I can't make it out. But there's a picture of a Moshe. So obviously on his desk there, you see that he has a book with Rav Moshe, a traditionalist conservative rabbi. And he's the one mentioned by name that as someone who you can accept his gittin. And he says, I know for certain that Rabbi Soloveitchik gave him a letter for the people in Israel testifying that Rabbi Silverman's gittin were to be accepted. There were other conservative rabbis or conservative figures. Boaz Cohen.
Boaz Cohen at the seminary, head of the Beis Din, the Rav Soloveitchik accepted his gittin. Norman Lamb wrote about this. So Lieberman, these are his students, and he is willing to defend them when he feels they're being improperly accused of not being in line with halacha. In fact, in one case, and in only one case, it does seem that Lieberman is so frustrated with the Orthodox that he seems to identify with the conservatives. This is only one case. The rest of the time, and he's explicit that he's not conservative. He's teaching there. But in one case, it does seem to cross over. And I get it. I understand why he was so upset. Louis Epstein, he always regarded himself as a traditional, what we would call today, Orthodox Jew. But when the Orthodox, when the rabbis rejected his approach to the Aguna problem, that's when he said, well, I can't be in this community because I feel that they're not properly dealing with these matters. Lieberman never went that far. That is, he never remained in that. But it does seem he crosses into it for a second. Let me just give you an example, because now we're going to move to discuss the Lieberman ketubah, which created so much controversy. I will say that for those who want to learn more, you can Google. You can Google the name of Tara Kelman, Orthodox Lieberman Cause, and you'll find this honors paper written by Tara Kelman, who is a teacher on Torah in Motion, and obviously the daughter of Rabbi Kelman, for those who know, and you can read all about the Orthodox objections to the Lieberman Cause. But let's talk about the Lieberman Cause, what it is. Well, before we get to that, let me go forward a bit and read you what, during the midst of this dispute, when the Lieberman Cause was being attacked, and Lieberman thought that all of the attacks were not based on halacha, but based on political reasons, that we can't give any authority to people in the other camp, he says as follows. And this is as close as he ever gets to, planting his tent on the conservative side. Quote, and this is reported in the Proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly. I saw that some of you were accused of being frightened by the Orthodox rabbis. I want to tell you that I'm not frightened by them at all. So already just that sentence, you see that the Orthodox rabbi is over here and I'm over here with you. I want to tell you, therefore, to give you a point of information. In truth, they were frightened. And I want you to know why they were frightened. They weren't afraid that the Beis Din, that is the Beis Din of this, it was a joint Beis Din of the seminary and the rabbinical assembly, would issue some takanot. No, not at all. They were afraid that the Beis Din will issue takanot in accordance with halacha. As a matter of fact, one of the very important members of the Orthodox rabbis said in so many words, if this Beis Din of the rabbinical seminary will issue a takana, this takana will be a kilkul, be a negative thing. It will be a great misfortune because they will get authority. And that's the reason they oppose this. Many of them think that the Beis Din will begin to move in this line. The movement can become strong. It will affect them. So here you see Lieberman explaining to the conservative rabbis why the Orthodox rabbis are opposed to them for political reasons. And he does sound as if his foot is in their camp. But this is only temporary. You never again see him at all speaking like this, where he's setting the Orthodox off against the conservatives. As I said, he's always identifying with the Orthodox, although he's very proud of what he's doing at the seminary teaching there, thinks it's important work, and thinks there's no problem for an Orthodox person to teach at an institution where he's teaching Torah, even if he doesn't agree with everything in the institution. Much like I teach, you could say I teach at a Catholic university, perhaps, and I don't agree with everything taught in the Catholic university. So what's this Lieberman ketubah all about? Well, Lieberman, the issue of the Aguna is, of course, one of longstanding, and we already saw the Epstein proposal. We spoke about other things. However, the Agunas that Epstein and others were talking about were the classic Aguna. Husband disappears in the war, that's the issue. You had in the 19th century people I mentioned who would come to America and just disappear. And that's also an aguna. And that was a problem also in the early 20th century as well. However, by the time you get to the 1950s, there's a different type of aguna. And that's the Aguna most of us know. It's very rare, unless you have a situation like the Twin Towers come down, we have Aguna, because the man went in there in the morning. We know he went in there, and then the building came down. Do we have proof he's no longer alive? The Agunas that we all know about are this new type of Aguna where we know where the man is. He hasn't disappeared. He just refuses to give a get. And what makes it so complicated because is often that these people claim that who don't give a get, they don't have to give a get. Sometimes they might have a reliable rabbi telling them. Other times they can go, there's a rabbi up in Muncie. All the modern Orthodox who don't want to give get, they go to this rabbi in Muncie and they pay him off. And he'll issue a shtar declaring, you got to see what he says about Refershel Schechter and the RCA and the other rabbis, the surrounding rabbis. He put them all in Chayram, this guy in Muncie. Obviously, he's a fraud, but he's getting it not accepted anywhere. But the stories you've heard, the guy, Mayor Kinn, of Los Angeles, who won't give his wife a get. And there's a few of these scoundrels who won't give it. So they all go to the same guy. So this is a new phenomenon. Because the reason it's a new phenomenon is because it used to be, unless you're a crazy guy, if you're going to get divorced, you want to get remarried. If you're religious, at least you're going to get remarried. But you don't need that anymore because you go to Muncie and he'll give you, this guy Gestetner up there, he'll give you a Heter Meir Rabbanim. And there's another guy also. I don't even know if Kishetner's still alive. There's two of them up there. But they'll give you a Heter Meir Rabbanim. So Merikin and the rest, they don't need to give the get. Normally, you'd have to give the get if you want to get remarried. No, you'll get a Heter Meir Rabbanim. You take a second wife. What's the problem? So that's the Aguna we have. And there's organizations. There's Ora. There's others. They try to put pressure on them sometimes. Look, it worked with the guy from Afghanistan. That last Jew in Afghanistan, he wouldn't give his wife a get. But when they got him out of Afghanistan, he agreed to do it. But this is a problem, obviously, because it really puts the Torah in a difficult situation because Torah is a Torah of mercy and it's pleasant. The Torah is pleasant, obviously. We know that. And yet here we have a situation where by using the Torah, people are doing incredible cruelty. So in situations like that, we know that often there's ways that the system offers you ways of finding solutions. We found solutions for all sorts of things, everything from heter iska to selling chametz, not at the same level, of course, of keeping in a woman on Aguna. But so is there an approach? Is there a solution? Or we just have to throw up our hands and say that no, that she can never remarry. So this has been a big issue throughout that. We could have a few classes just on the different proposals. You have proposals from recognized Gedolei Yisrael also, Rav Shmuel Yitzhak Hillman, from Rav Zevin, from Rav Henkin. Lots of people try to get proposals. I'll talk a little bit today about the RCA's proposal, which appears to be maybe the best of the proposals and actually works. I say work because I'm told by people in the RCA, they claim that among people who've signed the RCA prenuptial agreement, and I'll explain how it differs from the ketubah in a little bit, but there is not one case of an aguna from someone who signed the RCA prenuptial agreement. The problem is that you hear about these cases of agunas, it's often from the Haredi world. They oppose this. They don't believe in signing it. And that's the problem. So it could be that in at least the more modern world, when I say modern, I mean, Rav Asher Weiss is not what you call modern. Rav Zalman Nechemia Gober is not modern. Rav Avadia Yosef is not modern. Yet they gave their approbations also for the RCA prenuptial agreement. But let's get back to our story. We go a couple more minutes. Finkelstein turns to Lieberman in the 50s and says, we need to find an answer to the Aguna problem. And it's not just because of the issues I just mentioned. The problem is that there's a lot of pressure in the conservative movement. You have radicals and liberals and radicals in the conservative movement that their attitude is, we'll just... it's not a problem at all because we can just be mevatel the kiddushin. We can just avoid the marriage. And that was going to be their solution. So here you have a woman, she's married, the husband refuses to give her a get. So their attitude was that the RA, the rabbinical assembly based in, would just void the marriage and say, well, we have the authority. The rabbis give us the authority and every marriage we know is done with the authority of the rabbis. So we will just make a decree that if you don't give your wife a get, we will void the marriage. This does move into Orthodox circles at the end of the 20th century through Rabbi Rachman's Beis Din, the beginning of the 20th century through the Rabbi Krauss's Beis Din, and also even Rabbi Shmuel Kamenetsky. But these are all individual cases. You had people in the rabbinical assembly, their attitude is, we'll just through a takana, we'll create, we have the authority, we won't need a get anymore. So Finkelstein is very worried about this. And there is a wonderful, wonderful article by a Benjamin Steiner. It appears a couple of years ago, 2017, and then I think it's in American Jewish Archives. It's called The Lieberman Clause Revisited. He has all the stuff on what led to it. He also focuses on the fact that it wasn't just about the Aguna issue. The notion of strengthening marriage, and there's all these other things he calls attention to. But I want to read you what Finkelstein writes to Lieberman in 52. Quote, "This is our last chance to deal with the problem of Jewish law effectively in this country. If we cannot find someone within our faculty group who will make the application of Jewish law his life's interest, nothing will prevent incompetent people from undertaking this responsibility." He's worried that the RA, Rabbinical Assembly, rabbis, are going to make radical moves. And from Finkelstein's perspective, we need the Talmud faculty and you, Lieberman, the head of it. We need you to lead the way and keep the conservative movement in the fold, as it were. And that's going to be a big issue as we go forward. Who's really in charge here? Wait till you see about some of you. A lot of people probably think of the Lieberman clause. Well, the conservatives, that's the conservative approach. No, as we'll see, many conservative rabbis were completely opposed to the Lieberman ketubah because they said, this sounds like orthodoxy. We're creating a fix here and that's not what conservative Jews. I'll read you a text from a conservative rabbi. He says, I left Yeshiva University because I didn't want this type of a Jewish law, this type of orthodoxy. But this is Torah. And Finkelstein was an adherent of Torah, and he wanted, even obviously more liberal, of course, than the Orthodox, but they wanted it done in a halachically proper fashion. So what we will do next class is, we'll get into this detail. So what was the Lieberman, the ketubah of Lieberman? What did he propose to solve the Aguna problem? Why did the Orthodox oppose it so much? Was it only political, or was there a halachic argument? And I'll anticipate by saying there was a halachic argument. Norman Lamb, in one of his early articles, a detailed article, puts forth the halachic argument, although always in the background is the idea that this comes, and Lamb says it explicitly, that this is coming from the non-Orthodox institution, and that's something that can't be countenanced. And then we'll talk about a little bit, so how does this differ than the RCA? And what's the problem? And from there, we'll move on to then I think we're going to have to conclude after this. Lieberman is no longer persona grata in the Orthodox world, and we'll continue with our story. Next class, the big controversy broke out, and then I don't think next class, maybe the class after, we will return to his scholarship. But we're in the 1950s now, which unfortunately for Lieberman, his relations with the Orthodox is not, it's not a good time, because that really is the break. Also, next class, I'll show you the actual Lieberman ketubah. Also, the actual words we'll see, and we'll analyze it. Rabbi Kelman, when you were not with us, I think you had to leave for a little while, and I called attention to...
I was here the whole time.
Oh, okay.
The whole time. You called attention to my daughter, and you didn't know that Israel Silverman's my uncle. That you didn't even know. You should have asked me beforehand.
What, I didn't know who? Say again? Who's
Israel uncle? Silverman is my uncle.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He married my father's sister.
Oh, okay. So that's
easy. Rabbi for many, many years in Hamilton, and he did all the gittin, and he was, you know?
Well, I was happy to see that when you can just Google, they put it in Atara's paper, you can just Google it, and there it is. It's online. So anyone who's interested, you can get all the sources there. So let me take the questions. Rabbi Shuna says Kaplan got rid of Scharva Onesh. Yeah, he got rid of a lot more than that. He got rid of a personal god. Yeshaya Leibovitz also gets rid of the Scharva Onesh. And you have certain medievals who pretty much get rid of it in the way we think of it usually. But Kaplan did not believe in a personal god. So that's the way we think of it. So that's more even. William Gewertz, perhaps the punishment by God was somewhat offensive. The second paragraph is entirely positive. You can look at the sitter. There's many things in the Reconstruction sitter are simply lifted from the regular sitter because people are attached to it. So there's no problem in that. But when you want, the question is, they don't really, how they understand it, because they don't really have the same conception that most people think of when they're praying. But we have other examples of this. So, for instance, the Jains. The Jains are a group in India. They're atheists, but they pray. Buddhists, many Buddhists pray, if you call that pray. Well, they meditate, I wouldn't say pray, but Jains actually pray. They don't believe in God, so what are you praying? So you can pray. You pray, it helps your inner peace, all these sorts of things. Nat Lewin says, Shmona Esrei remove man, Machaye Mesimbe. Yeah, yeah, it's, I'll read it to you again. In my book, Changing the Immutable, I looked at how Machaye Mesim is translated in various sidurim. So, for instance, in the conservative sitter, they don't translate it literally. But in the, I'm looking at the sitter here, the contemporary sitter of the Reconstructionists, and they say as follows. It's funny. I just found the Amida, but in that, the Amida I just saw, they cut it out. They call it Amida Katsara. But so let me find another Amida here. Yes, so if you look in, this is, I think, Shabbos morning, it's V'nema Natachayos Kochai. Faithful are you in giving life to every being, living being. So L'Hachayos Kochai doesn't really mean, it refers to resurrection, but they, Baruch Atah Hashem Mechaye Kochai. Blessed are to you, not Mechaye HaMesim, who Mechaye Kochai means who gives and renews life. So, the conservative sitter didn't do that. I mean, you can deny Tchias HaMesim literally, and you can understand it as identical to immortality. So Machai HaMesim will mean cause the dead to live, namely eternally. But that's not what they do there. Jay Yell and now Rabbi Yaakov Yellen, the sanctity of the synagogue has recently been repented. Yes, it has. And look, there's a whole story. You have the Mount Clemens case. Yeah, you had the case of synagogue. He was very involved in it, Litvin, about... what do? You have a synagogue. People gave money to it. It was an Orthodox synagogue. Then the membership decides to change it. They want to change it to a conservative synagogue. Can you argue that the money was given to an Orthodox synagogue and therefore by changing it, you're breaking faith with the early donors? So it was a big court case. So that's the reason why the Young Israel movement, they had this strange thing that the rights to the synagogue were actually given to the main office of Young Israel. They were very afraid of synagogues established as Orthodox then would become non-machitza synagogues, become conservative. And this way, they had the ultimate authority. This led, of course, to the disgrace at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st, I can't remember, where Orthodox Young Israel synagogues were being threatened that if they did things in line with their post scheme, that they could have the synagogue removed, taken away from them. And some of you are probably members of Young Israel, you know about how they had to clean house and everything, but I was in a synagogue in Syracuse where the rabbi, it's hard to be a president. And not many people in a place, especially a small community like Syracuse, if you have anyone to volunteer to be a president, you're going to be happy to have it. So he asked Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, and Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz told him that the woman could be the president. It's okay. That was his opinion. And the rabbi instituted this. And so what are they doing? The Young Israel office is threatening. They're going to confiscate the shul and crazy stuff like that. I mean, it was insane. But the basis of it was because of years ago of the fear that it would go conservative. Ruth says, Rav Lishus is my cousin, Chaim Isaac Waxman's father-in-law. As I said, I one of my very good friends is a big Talmud of. He was in Rav David's shir. I never went to YU, but he came. I remember when I was in BMT in 1985, Rav David came and he gave a shir in Hebrew, Ashkenazic Hebrew, not Sephardic Hebrew, Ashkenazic Hebrew. Morris asks, what about the prohibition to teach students who are not appropriate? We'll get to that next class, because that's what Shulam Roth, he has a responsum explaining why what Lieberman is doing is so bad. And he actually cites this, this prohibition. So we'll get to that. Rabbi Shudnow says, in Yerushalayim, I once questioned Rabbi Lieberman how the JTS rabbinical school can have non-observant teachers. He answered that they are teaching technical subjects, but not actual Torah. They could teach homiletics, but it's iffy though, because I think Kaplan might have taught Mesilas Yesharim. So many of them did teach, but Kaplan, he didn't do that in rabbinical school though. He did it in Teachers Institute. So what's the difference in rabbinical school and the Teachers Institute? It's hard. Look, all I can say is that Rabbi Lieberman, Shaul Lieberman, to his own mind at least, was able to justify it. At the very end, we'll see that the same issues that fell on Shaul Lieberman fall on Rabbi Faur from the Syrian community, the exact same issues, and we'll see how they played out. Rabbi Hartman says, what about the Chazon Ish? I'm not sure what you mean. You mean asking the Chazon Ish. Ah, well, the reason I didn't think so, it's a good question. You think, I mean, that would be the logical the thing, but I'll tell you why I didn't think so. Because in the letter, he says as follows. He consulted with Shlosha Gedolei Yerushalayim, with three sages of Jerusalem. The Chazon Ish didn't live in Jerusalem. It's hard to see how he couldn't have consulted with his cousin. But he doesn't mention that. Maybe his cousin told him, don't come. That's not, I don't know. There is no correspondence with them that I could find between them once he comes to America. I don't know. Rabbi Shunau says, I was present on Simchas Torah. Only men danced with Sifrei Torah. If Lieberman was asked to allow women to dance, he refused, saying, if women dance with the Torahs, they might as well sit together with men. Rabbi Shunau, when we come to the end, the very end, and we deal with the creation and his bracha for the committee on halacha process, we'll talk about how Lieberman's conservative with a small c tendencies in so many of these areas. But in the end, it's a failure in the sense that he thought he would be able to keep it a certain way. And as long as Finkelstein was there, he could. Joel Roth records that there was a woman came to the JTS Minyan once, and she was wearing tefillin. This is how I recall the story. She was wearing tefillin, something which you could find even in some Orthodox minyanim. And Lieberman told Roth to go tell her, you know, not to do it. That's my recollection. It was tefillin, not a talus. Maybe it was a talus. I can't remember. And Roth says, Rebbe, is this halachically incorrect, what she's doing? And Lieberman says, I won't say it's halachically, but it's not aesthetic. In other words, it's not the proper thing to do in a show. And Roth says that he told him, if you tell me it's halachically inappropriate, I'll tell her. But I'm not going to tell her if it's just aesthetic. So Lieberman had a very traditional sense.
I was present.
So is it tefillin?
It was tefillin, and I saw the grush, how he was looking. He kept looking back and like, how could this be? And what are we going to, what is this? Yeah. Pardon me for interrupting, but.
No, thank you. That's the great, the best interruption. Maurice asks, wasn't Isaac Klein's Piskei Halacha also accepted by the Orthodox? No, Isaac Klein's Piskei Halacha were not. If you read his book, he has a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which any Orthodox person could read. It's a fine work, as long as you take out what he says about cheese and wine, and also swordfish. But it's a very big book. So if you take out those few pages, you still have probably like 400 pages. Isaac Klein, he's a big Lamdin, comes from Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, but his psakim were not accepted by the Orthodox, although I'm told his descendants are all Orthodox and they accept their Zaydi's views. Someone privately asked me, in my view, was Lieberman's decision to remain at the seminary a huge mistake? Although he's admired by some and his genius is recognized, he certainly does not have the recognition he would have had had he gone to YU. Was it a poor decision? Let's wait to the end, because there is a tragic element. He gave his whole life, basically, or the second half of his life, to the institution, and we'll see what happens, and we're going to go through his tshuva against women rabbis, which today would be regarded as reactionary, because you have all these, in the liberal Orthodox world, you have women rabbis, and his letter, his short letter, which I published for the first time it ever appeared in print, to the Committee on Halachic Process. So in a sense, it is tragic because it didn't work out the way he hoped it would. So I'll give my judgment, as it were. Who am I to judge? But just as a historian, judgment. Rabbi Shudno says, Rabbi David Lincoln studied at Yeshiva's Kol Torah in Beit Vegan. He was my rabbi for Chicago. I don't know David Lincoln. I'm not sure what that's related to. Now, what about Eliezer Berkovitz's proposal? Well, Eliezer, if you go to Torah, these classes have encouraged a lot of people. I'm getting emails a couple times a week of people listening to the Torah in Motion website, the podcasts, including someone who just emailed me about Eliezer Berkovitz. So if you're interested in the podcast, I did about four or five classes on Berkovitz. You can go to the Torah in Motion website, and there I talk about Berkovitz's proposal. But Berkovitz's proposal comes out of the same genre and the same milieu as Lieberman's, that we have to do something about the Aguna problem, not just because of the women who are suffering, because it's Chil Hashem. It's bringing disgrace on the Torah that the scoundrels can just leave their wives and they go off and do whatever they do. There has to be some solution. And there is a solution, but sometimes it just takes the rabbis, they have to work at it. They try, they come back and forth, and eventually they'll come up with something. And I think, as I said, with the RCA, which we'll look at it next class, we've come up with something which doesn't maybe help the people who've already married, but if they follow the way they're supposed to, it's appropriate. And I'll tell you something, many people who oppose the Lieberman proposal, they oppose the Epstein proposal in the Orthodox world. I'm not talking about Lamb. Lamb gives good halachic arguments. We'll talk about them. But a lot of people gave this attitude that this is, they're getting married. In the Lieberman book, I quote Rabbi Jacob Levinson saying that the day they're getting married, you're talking to them about divorce. What kind of insane person are you? This is the happiest day of their life. No, every rabbi today, They some of them do it. I know my kids, it was done the day of the wedding. During the Chasan Sish, they signed the prenuptial agreement. Not only that, one of my kids, under the chuppah, the rabbi said in describing that this day, and he says, I want to tell you that both the Chasan signed the document, and he explained for all the people what was signed, why it's important that this is done for the sake of Kol Yisrael. We all do this today, and we all should do this, and no one thinks anything of it, because, look, this is an act of love. You love the wife. God forbid something in the future happens. At least now you're doing the proper thing. But when you read the way people describe how insane it is to talk about this when they're getting married, it shows you that for many of them, it wasn't halachic arguments. It was coming from the wrong side. That's always going to be a problem. Mari calls attention to Rabbi Riskin's proposal. Yes, Rabbi Riskin has a proposal, never not accepted. Nat Lewin, of course, obviously the expert in all these matters, and we'll talk. Nat Lewin told me a very interesting story about, wait till you hear who ended up supporting the ketubah, the Lieberman ketubah, at least for legal purposes. I'll read from his letter about, and in the Avitzer versus Avitzer case, which shows, I'll tell you, all the people in X class who said that this would never stand up. And yet it did stand up in court. And Nat Lewin, of course, was a major participant and perhaps the reason for this standing up in court. I'll tell you the story. But Nat says, the legal issue in the Mount Clemens case was whether removal of Mechitza was a departure from doctrine. And the Michigan Supreme Court held it was. iPad asks, the Young Israel donations, what about the return in Germany of reparations and the property of Reform synagogues destroyed by the Nazis and given today to Orthodox community? The way it's done, I think they assume that all these, if they know who it is, then they give it back. But these synagogues were destroyed. If you could say, for instance, there are synagogues in Berlin that are still there from pre-war. If you can show that these books or this stuff came from that synagogue, they'll give it to them. But the rest of them, they've decided after the war to distribute them to synagogues. So they never said, well, if it came from a foreign synagogue, it shouldn't go to an Orthodox or even vice versa. They just decided to give them out. And I think that's appropriate. And finally, or two more, a private question. Someone wants to know, is there halachic discussion of publishing private correspondence, such as the one you mentioned from Lieberman, et cetera? That's an old dispute, but every issue of Moria and Sefer Yovel and every auction, they're publishing private correspondence every day of the week, almost from the Rambam to every Gadol B'Yisrael. The assumption is that Gedolim, when they send letters, it's understood that they're not just private, that they speak the Torah message, and that I'm not talking about if they, you know, they stub their toe or something like that, but anything of substance. And this has been the tradition forever. Anything of substance that any great rabbi ever says in any letter is regarded as Torah and is continuously published, always published. And there's journals that exist just to publish this sort of stuff. And I include Lieberman among these as well. And finally, Rabbi Kalman says the ketubah is even worse, in quotes. I recall Rabbi Lookstein taught how a rabbi should never translate ketubah at a wedding. Half the people might walk out. Okay.
Ketubah is the first prenuptial agreement. That's what it
yes,
is.
Yes, but the problem is
there's something the opposite reason.
That's the point that you can't. What you're saying is correct, that if people think that it's a disgrace to talk about divorce under the chuppah, the ketubah itself is designed for that. So, of course, we look at that. But the Lieberman will get into this. The problem with the Lieberman ketubah is the vagueness. It leads to this issue called asmachta that we'll talk about. But okay, through trial and error, as I said, I'll read you at the end, and then I'll talk to you about the RCA. We seem to have come up with Nat, who's been with us. If you look in Yeshurin, there's a whole discussion on the get law, New York get law, and he was involved with that as well. And these are complicated things. I don't want to get into that. There's people who are experts, obviously Nat Ruin from the legal side, and there's halachic experts. I just want to focus on, and we'll do this next class, what Lieberman was trying to do with the ketubah and the larger issue, because this then becomes the Orthodox conservative conflict, and it really marks the end. Lieberman refused to back down, and this marks the end of his really acceptance as an Orthodox authority. And ironically, as I'll tell you next class, the conservative movement changed the Lieberman ketubah. So the one that you see today is actually not Lieberman's original ketubah. But we've gone long enough, so Rabbi Kalman, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much. Of course, on the private letter issue, Dr. Shapiro was the center of a big storm when he published a private correspondence between the Sri Aish and Rav Shmuel Atlas, his good friend who was deacon at HUC. I'm sure many of you recall that from years back. And J.J. Schechter then wrote a whole piece on the truths of history. If not, it's highly recommended reading in tradition from, I don't know what
year. Torah Monitor.
How many? We're going back probably 10, 12 years at least, no?
No, more.
Time flies. So that's, publishing private. But that's, J.J. Schechter wrote like a 70-page article on that whole issue in response to Dr. Shapiro publishing those letters. Okay, thank you very much. We look forward to next week. And tomorrow morning, Rachel Sharansky-Danziger continues her series. We've got all our regular classes. We've got online classes, please God. And mentioned the Parshat HaShavua this week by Rivka Freundlich from Montreal. And we look forward to learning with you and your friends. And please let people know. Please pass along the good words. And absolutely go listen on YouTube, on audio. You can go on the program page, the Tim Torah page, and get hundreds, thousands, really, of past recordings. And any comments, please let us know. And have a wonderful day. Good night. Laila Tov, everybody. We look forward to learning with you in the near future. Thank you very much.